Yesterday, we started our discussion on death. I suggested a title for this thing, Everybody Does It. And we raised a number of issues during this period. We asked why talk about death, and briefly we made some statements in this regard. We said that if we haven't got anything to say about death, we don't have anything to say about life either. We quoted Augustine in his Confessions when he pled for a keener sense of death, not because he wished to dull the thirst for life, but for precisely the opposite reason, to intensify the self's awareness of life. And Seneca said, no man enjoys the true taste of life, but he who is willing and ready to quit it. And we sort of yesterday then tried to look at this question of why talk about death. And we also went into some other questions that we thought might be worth discussing here. And I might have forgotten some of those that you brought up, but I think they're somewhere in my notes, and I've gone back on these tapes. And if you have not heard what we discussed yesterday, not my part of it, but what Carol had to say, I think this is a very important a message that he has, and if there's nothing else that comes out of this, I hope at least his part of it does come out. We discussed what are the hazards, or rather we said one of the questions we should answer is, what are the hazards and benefits of grief? How long will I live? What will I die from? And on this matter of grief, we said, well, we should define what grief is. I think Carol did a very good job of telling you what suffering was. On the matter of grief, I remember I erred there as far as the periods. I said periods of grief. I should have said periods of mourning. I mean, what is the benefit of set periods of mourning? How sharp is the sting of death? Why can't I live forever? Is death the end? And when we get to that, I'll quote from, among other people, I was just looking over some material today, and I have some material from a fellow I've come to know, and he's one of the more interesting people I do know. His name is Jack Eccles. In Australia, I guess he's known as Sir John Eccles. He took the Nobel Prize a few years ago for his work on the nervous system. He is also a theologian. And he has something to say about this. What about heaven? Is death the wage of sin? What should we do for the dying and those who grieve? And another issue, and I know I intended to provoke some reaction, and we got it, on the matter of pulling the tubes. Or dying a dignified death. And we had some examples of some exceptions on this. I think Carol stated it so well when he said, in our world today, we're not allowed to live, and they won't let us die. Now, today I thought it would be very useful to start out by discussing this matter of dying, manner of dying. I guess that first we have to sort of say what life is, or define death. But to start out, I was very interested in a recent article in Medical Opinion and Review. It was in 69. And it happened in one of our states. This person, he was a freshman in the Florida House of Representatives, and he sort of dropped in a bill in the hopper. It was one of the shortest bills, I guess, submitted. And to the Basic Rights article of the Constitution of the State of Florida, he wanted to add about seven words. And I'll read you the first part of the of this Basic Rights article and then show you what he wanted to put in. All natural persons are equal before the law and have an inalienable right, or have inalienable rights, among which are the right to enjoy and defend life, liberty, and he wanted to insert the words, to be permitted to die with dignity. Now, do you think that the bill passed? No, it didn't. The bill did not pass. But there was a very great reaction to this, a tremendous reaction. It happened to be in an election year when he submitted it. Many of the people came and told him they were in sympathy with it, but he should have put it in an off-election year, you know. Wait 2 years, you know. And almost all of his correspondence and his letters that he received, which he didn't really predict, were all in favor of it, with a few exceptions. There were two cards unsigned that says, "Who do you think you are, Hitler? Or who do you think you are, God?" And to an extent, you are God when you have to make these decisions. And we, in a way, do leave it up to the medical profession. And the medical profession has as its primary duty, first, last, and always, the preservation of life without concern for the nature of that life. And I guess the question before the House, is that right? Now, there are three people who, or three professions, I guess, at least, who are involved when we, around the dead person. A fellow named Gunnar Bjork has addressed this question at an international law conference, an international meeting of the professions. He himself is a lawyer. And he addressed this question on life and death. And he said that, you know, there are three people who meet around the person who is dying: medicine, religion, and law. Medicine has to do what I just told you it has to do. This is its responsibility. We will have more to say about what religion has to do about it. And law protects the integrity of the defenseless human being, ostensibly. And I think there comes a conflict here. In fact, there are now conflicts in the courts. As we look at the definition, for example, of life or death, and Gunnar Bjork gets into this, he says that, and he goes into the problem of, you know, what is a human being? When does a fetus become a human being? If you abort a fetus, when is it a human being? In Swedish law, after birth it breathes, even one breath. Or if there's some form of pulsation there, that's life. Now he goes on to say too that the tradition of the great religions of our world has established human life as a supreme value, which is guarded by written and unwritten law, and not to be terminated by human acts other than those according to law, or not at all. So what is this human element? Now, I suppose if we went around the room today and said, what do you think is human? The immediate answer usually say, well, it sort of should have a human body, and probably some kind of mental activity. So then we can start cutting off pieces. you take off a leg, are they still human? Well, most of you'd probably say yes. If he's a tetraplegic, have no arms and no legs, you'd probably still say he's human, or she is human. We have a lot of people in iron lungs today, the head's working in a way, you know. But if we had some way just to keep the head and nothing else, would this be a human being? Or, as in the case in Canada, where an individual was involved in an automobile accident, he was brought into the emergency hospital, and they put in tubes into his trachea, into his windpipe. They cut a hole in his stomach and put a tube into his stomach. They also now and then put him on intravenous therapy. And his brain never came back. I mean, his brain really wasn't there. I mean, even the lower centers. And for 8 years, 8 months, and 19 days, this is how he was. Periodically, he'd go into convulsions and run a temperature. He had continual care, probably at the cost of from $30,000 to $50,000 a year. Was he a human being? These are hard questions. I say the legal profession gets into it. Right now, I think, or very recently, there was a court case in England where this fellow was in a barroom brawl, and he was very seriously injured, so that he really lost the function of his lower centers of his brain. His respiration wouldn't work, so they had to put on an apparatus to help him breathe so he could get oxygen. The physician essentially pronounced him dead with this because his brain wasn't able to function. But they had the machine going, you see. The coroner says that was, I think, the 16th of June. And so the attending physician says the day of death is then. You see, these people are becoming more and more valuable today, because he had a good set of kidneys. He also had a good heart. And so they told the next of kin, the wife, and she understood, you know, that he was pronounced dead. Could the kidneys be shared? So they took out the kidneys on the 17th, and following the removal of the kidneys and their transplantation, they turned the machine off. The coroner said he died on the 17th. Well, probably everything would have been all right, except against the wishes of everyone, the papers obtained the information, and it became a national issue. And what was the cause of death? The barroom brawl? Because some people were involved in it. That could be, of course, tried for at least manslaughter. Was it the people who turned off the machine? And so it becomes a legal problem. We didn't used to have this problem. When I was young, this was not a problem. We had what we called the old man's friend. We die from pneumonia many times. They wouldn't let my father die with pneumonia. They'd always bring him back from it. And they managed to bring my mother back from it for a couple of days.
That was Sir William Osler's contribution to human philosophy.
What was his contribution?
He called pneumonia the friend of the aged. Way, way back in the days when Sir William Osler was the father of medicine, especially in America.
Another interesting thing about him, he wouldn't have more about 7 patients at a time, if I remember right. Well, they don't work with too many for one physician to take care of.
He also made a remarkable statement in 1912 to the Yale graduating class, the class in medicine. He said, "I have two very disturbing things to tell you. The first one is that half of what we have told you isn't true. And the other point I want to make is even more disturbing. We don't know which half it is." And we haven't got all the answers, you know. When you're dealing with a human being or an organism, it seems infinitely complex. Now, in the old days, as I say, we had a simple problem. I mean, it wasn't a great big problem. We gathered around the old folks and said our fond farewells. But now we have to redefine death, and it's become more critical more recently because of this matter of transplants. I'm not so sure myself whether these are great things. We got a long ways to go yet before we're able to, at least I think we got a ways to go before we really understand this rejection mechanism. There's a tense work on it now. Last year you would have read that, boy, we got this thing licked because we have anti-lymphocytic serum, and if we give that, we'll prolong these things, these transplanted hearts. But you're going to find out that if you use an anti-lymphocytic serum, that then you're subject to all kinds of other infections, and possibly cancers among them. At least this is the case in animals. So it is not an easy road, as we saw in that movie. The way of the investigator is not always spectacular. It's slow, hard work. And we reach a lot of dead ends. And can you justify an operation on a 60-year-old person or one even my age? The investment of the time and talent and money to give me 10 more years when that same money would save the life of many small children who have their life in front of them. These are the kind of problems that we have to face. And I provoked some, not riot, but some reaction, when I told you that I have instructed my family that I don't want all these tubes, you know. I don't want them to put an artificial heart, an artificial kidney machine, and have the tubes running in and keeping me breathing and running IV into my system. And I just don't want it, you know. And I don't want a whole bunch of surgery when I have cancer.
Don't you think here, too, one of the things that comes to me is Dr. L.W. Bull told a story on himself about how a particular physician down here in Northfield, he'd been to see him to get some money for St. Olaf College at that moment, usually in need, and he asked him for a sum of money, I think $1,000 or so, and the doctor said, "But I gotta live." And Pexy Bo said, "Why?" And you do have to ask why here, don't you? I mean, now there may be reasons why this should happen to you. One thing bothers me, for instance, in this matter of mass death, which our society faces. And so many Christians say, "I don't wanna survive the bomb." You know, it sounds very pious. Let me go up with the rest of them. But the one who survives is the one that's going to have the mess to clean up. The one that has to go back to the old primitivism and live without all our engineering feats and without our plumbing and with every kind of plague and stuff that's going to follow. Who's going to be responsible for cleaning up the earth and redeeming it again when we have followed it up with our atomic war? which we all know is going to happen. It's just in the book as far as men are concerned. Okay, it'd be much more pleasant not to be here. The reason why I say this is because there was a real death wish for most of us in prison camp. I mean, we'd rather have died than keep on going with this day by day by day kind of continual psychological torture and the pressures of hunger itself. You lose your memory. This was a terrible thing to happen to us. We couldn't even remember each other right nearby. You couldn't remember your past. Your memory was gone. We already knew everything that senility knows, because malnutrition does this to you. We looked horrible. We didn't like to look at each other. All our women were swollen up with edema. This is watery legs, big, huge legs, and so on. And it was a frightful thing to look at each other, even, because the pain and suffering that comes when you love one another at that moment. That's when I found this discovery I said yesterday. Pain, what's happened to me. Suffering is what happened when I look at you. And we almost hated to look at each other because of what's happening to each other. And I found at this moment in my proclamation that I had to reach a chord that I had never reached before in my preaching here in America as a youngster. I had to call on the race. I had to remind us, look what the race has suffered to get you through to here. Your ancestors made bread out of bark. They dug the soil for worms. They didn't give up. You can't give up for the sake of the race. Sure, it's better to depart and be with Christ, and this is what you'd like to do. You'd like to opt out of this, but you've got to go through this. And there may be times in an individual case where a man has to say, like Paul, it's better that I remain with you, that I take all this filthy operations for the next 5 years, because I'm on the midst of an experiment which, if I see through it, might just mean something for countless others. Or I'm in the midst of a mission which, if I don't do, nobody else at this moment seems ready for. I don't know, nobody's expendable, a fellow can say, but we know this isn't true. There are times the right moment, the right place means everything for a nation. This is what you have to say, you see. And that's why the decision is so complex at this moment. Leo can say, I don't want this kidney. But his wife can't say it.
I've been asked to butt in at times, yeah, from a medical point of view on this discussion. I'm glad to do that if I'm not out of line.
Always. Come in.
I have a lot of reservation about that last statement Dr. Bustad made. I don't want this because I'm so old. That's an old cliche among people. I'm too old to have this operation. We hear that every day. Now, modern medicine and modern surgery has made that attitude wrong. Today, surgery on 80, 90-year-old people is relatively as safe as it is on young people, with the understanding of the body physiology and the proper evaluation. Surgery can be very relatively safely done on old people, and they have, in the doctor's mind, just as much right to the benefit of surgery to live a few years longer than a fellow that's 40 or 50 or 60. The attitude of the medical profession now is that the decision to do surgery should not rest on how many years you've lived, but on the condition, the indication for surgery. Of course, it's a real question as to whether to do elective surgery, that is surgery that is merely improvement in their comfort of living. Even that is considered perfectly proper to do on the right patient, under the right situation. But just because a person is old is not a reason for not giving him the benefit of modern surgery. The indication for surgery is another thing. To do surgery on somebody who is approaching a terminal stage, to make them live maybe a month longer or something like that could be another question. But I think there is too much of that attitude among the public, or has been. I think they're gradually coming out of it, that just because you're an old individual doesn't mean that surgery can't be safely performed. And they're entitled to it. Don't you agree?
Well, I think the argument on this point gets down to that the decision as to who makes the decision, and it must not rest with just one person, whether he be surgeon, next of kin, which is a very difficult thing, or the person involved. And we have had discussions on this within my family. And my wife, if she's here, she can cite an incident of dignity of death, or have dignity with death. And this has to do with something you got to, the decision that this might be terminal. I mean, there's some very heroic things we go through today in the last few days, which I say are unnecessary. This is the point I'm getting.
You're talking about experimental circuitry.
Well, yes, or all of these, all of the machines, just to keep my, if my brain processes are gone, if I've lost, if my oxygen has been shut off, and on this matter of death, let me just define death here for this purpose, or to say that death is a gradual thing. I mean, if I quit breathing, that's no sign that I'm dead. I mean, parts of me are dead. I mean, parts of me are dying all the time. The cells of my lining of my intestinal tract and many other cells are going under continual death. They're being replaced every couple of days. So that part of it's dying. But if the oxygen is shut off to my higher centers, for 4 to 6 minutes, there's irreversible damage.
Yes, of course. No surgeon with any conscience would operate on a person that's already dead. And medically speaking, I think the criterion for death now is a negative electroencephalogram with no brain waves.
They call a flat line here.
That's right.
Yeah, I was going to get into that, and although this hasn't not been accepted fully in the United States yet.
Well, not the lawyers, maybe, but I think the doctors have.
Yes, yeah. Except there was a recent case in a child, I think he was about 8 years old, and they did have a flat EEG, and they went through some heroics and recovered, and he had a recovery. Now, you see, I guess maybe it's the exception that proves the rule.
It's the one case, maybe.
Yeah, but the EEG, it's still... We don't fully understand the EEG, except we know that it manifests electrical activity in the brain as an EKG, is an indication of activity, the electrical activity in the heart. But we know, a person, and we have a lot of cases of it, he walks in, he gets his EKG, boy, he says, my heart's great, That night he dies from a heart attack.
Well, in that connection, it's interesting that in the public mind, the heart has always been considered the focus of life.
Yeah.
And that is, of course, totally wrong. The heart is, apart from the body, it's really a mechanical pump. That's all it is. And people can live with an artificial heart, even if they could, as much as with a transplanted heart, if it wasn't for this rejection of foreign substance in the body. That is the problem, as you said. Maybe they will overcome that yet. Also, as far as transplants are concerned, there are many transplanted organs that have been very successful and permanently successful. I'm talking now about a kidney, for example. There are a great many people now. I don't know the statistics, but I wish I did know, have some idea how many people are alive and well with a transplanted kidney. They seem to resist the rejection far better than many other organs, and especially the heart, it seems. Many people are going about their business with good vision because they have transplanted cornea from some other person's eyes. And transplantation isn't a thing to just write off.
And also bone.
Will an electroencephalogram distinguish between activity of the cerebral hemispheres and that of the cerebellum? And it seems to me that if a person's cerebral activity is good, or the cerebellum, which controls the breathing and that kind of stuff, isn't, it's still justified in keeping him going if he's a bright person, like Einstein or something like that. And that there's no point in letting a person die as long as his thinking processes are unimpaired.
If he has no brain waves on the electroencephalogram, his brain isn't functioning.
Yes, but now what I'm saying is, could a
and
person...
it doesn't come back.
Could a person's cerebral activity be good?
No, not without an encephalogram.
I mean,
but he's asking, can you distinguish?
Could a person's cerebrum be dead and still have brain waves due to the cerebellum?
Yeah. In other words, can he think...
The cerebellum is part of the brain, and I think the cortex, the cerebral cortex, which in which the centers of the higher centers are located, thinking and memory and all of that, voluntary effort, that's to us the important part of the brain, because that's where our emotions, our thinking, and all that.
Now what I'm saying is, could that be dead, but you still have brain waves with the cerebellum, keeping you breathing, your heart beating, and that kind of thing, which would be sensitive, let a person go living like a vegetable then.
Yeah,
the cerebellum can function without the rest of the brain. The brainstem is the center of the brain, really.
Now, but if you have a clot, say, in the cerebellum, where some of it's compromised, you could still cerebrate.
Oh,
in other words, you could think.
If then you'd be a stroke patient.
That's right. That's right.
Or hemiplegic.
Yeah.
And
it's not uncommon. And that's not death. That's right.
No, but you could have a situation where the breathing center was shut off, couldn't you? And you could keep a person breathing with a machine.
All right.
Your brain will keep working.
Polio is a good case.
Polio. We've all seen polio patients that have been perfectly well and alive cerebrally and every other way, but they cannot breathe without the artificial respirator. And I've seen people live for several years, and you all know people who've lived for several years by having mechanical breathing with their brain functions all right. Polio doesn't affect the brain.
Yes.
That's an entirely different matter.
And I suppose a person is unconscious. Can you determined by his, I suppose he's unconscious for weeks. Can you determine by an electroencephalogram whether or not his cerebrum, his cerebral cortex is out of commission or not?
Well, I hesitate to answer that because I have not, I mean, I've run EEGs, but I haven't done enough of them. And you know, I don't think it's... And I know some of the big boys in the business, and I don't know if they'll make too many predictions on just what these mean, except that there is activity there. I'll go along on the kidney transplants, and also you can, of course, operate without kidneys. Now, that wasn't true a long time ago. I have a good friend of mine. He doesn't have any kidneys, right? He's arenal. Huh? The other day, he flew to England for a meeting.
He spent 2 days a week on the kidney machine.
Of course, he's on the kidney machine for a couple of days. And they have had more success recently on kidney transplants. And part of this, a need for definition of death, is to try to get your kidneys fresh. It helps a lot. The potential for a successful transplant depends in great part upon the health of that organ, which does deteriorate with time. And there are means now, they're trying to work on methods to keep it better longer.
Well, many kidney transplants are done, the donors are living people.
That's why they're successful.
Because a person can get along very well with one good kidney and live as long as they could with two. And particularly that would be true of identical twins, where you can have less bother with the rejection problem, and a twin may give up one kidney for her twin to keep her alive. There's much of that sort of thing be done. Parents give up one kidney to save a situation for some of their children who may not have any kidney. So, well, there are many angles to transplantation, and it certainly is probably the biggest, most exciting advance in medicine and surgery that has happened in the last couple of decades. As we all know, because newspapers and media are full of it, and as Dr. Houston said, it's still a real problem, this rejection business, and the research that's being done on it may very well come up with better answers. The problem, of course, that has been uppermost in public and legal minds has been, when is the donor dead? When you may go in there and remove a heart, for example, of which he could not continue to live, and the fear that some ambitious surgeons or researchers or medical hospitals and so forth become overly ambitious and jump the gun a little bit. I think that's so very carefully controlled, and I personally think that they go pretty much by the use of the electroencephalogram as the final authority on when a patient is dead. As far as I know, isn't that your impression that that's the...
Yeah, the French started this back in about 68, I guess, and more or less said this is how we operate. The EEG will define death as the essentially a flat wave, and I think Mass General, Stanford Research, and a few other places in this country essentially took the same attitude, and although it hasn't been legally accepted yet, as you point out, this is what they're going to now.
That would be, to me, in accord with what I think is basic to our whole discussion here, the biblical issue that's the foundation of both Old and New Testaments. Peter picks up for his baptismal sermon in the New Testament, in 1 Peter, the tremendous text in the Old, Psalm 34, he that would love life and see good days. I mean, that life is good, that it's not something from which we escape, that there's not a veil of sorrows and so on. This kind of corruption in out of a North European sort of climatic situation. Those of you who came from North Europe, you can't realize how slow our forebears were to discover America. I would have swum the ocean if I'd had any notion it was here before. They get days and days like what we have now, they get for months, you know, what we've had for a week here. Literally, they live on a peninsula out in the sea and the clouds cover it, and it's gloomy. And in Norway, you can't imagine the feeling until you've lived with it. At 2 o'clock in the afternoon, there isn't any sun again, and at 10 in the morning, you're getting it up. And that's Oslo. That's South Norway. When you get up a little further, there's no sun at all for months on end. So you can sort of talk about a veil of tears and gloomy and so on. The climate made you feel this way. That's why they invented the things that heat the body, these good liquors. It was cheaper to heat the body than the house, but to be cold and wet and miserable than everything else. You know, like Hans Nielsen Hauge had his own still. Didn't have anything against liquor. He didn't like taxes. And I think that this idea of a good life was difficult sometimes in that climate to sustain. They found their ways of doing it, and they gave us this tremendous Christmas celebration of life in the midst of death and so on. But all these things contributed to what basically in the scriptures is very clear. Life is good. It's something to be cherished. It's a gift. It's to be used, and it's a daily sense of wonder and even bewilderment that you're permitted this enrichment that's called life with one another day by day. That, I think, is basic to our discussion, and that's what we're talking about. Now, when you no longer can perceive, respond in any sense, only God is responding to you, and this is still what makes you truly human, and we can't lose this. And the minute we lose that, we can expand this EKG to a lot of other things, and you've got Hitler again getting rid of all the misfits. But in between someplace here, we have to find our way. And that's where we don't know our way. I mean, this honest confusion is, I think, a great moment.
I would like to add another comment about the transplantation deal. That is, in fact, a practical application of the philosophy of life and death, which existed long before they attempted transplantation. For many years, medical men have reacted against this thing that Dr. Bustad said of keeping somebody alive mechanically, if you're medically, if you want to put it that way, who is otherwise dead, a vegetative individual whose brain centers, which is the source of biologic existence, really, because without the brain functioning, biologic life really can't go on indefinitely. Dr. Reneerson from Mayo Clinic is a very famous, well-known internist who started it within the medical profession quite a number of years ago about raising objections to physicians keeping people living who are hopelessly irrecoverable and who are vegetative from their from the point of their brain function, their emotions, their consciousness, their thought processes, and why go to the trouble, the expense, the suffering, and the worry. In such a case, as Dr. Bust had recited about a man who lived for 8 years and some months with adequate intravenous therapy, respired mechanical respiration, and the same thing applies to restarting the heart once it's stopped. Unfortunately, doctors have learned how to start a heart that has stopped, and it isn't very difficult to do. At first, we used to have to open the chest with anything available, especially on the operating table. If somebody had a cardiac arrest and the heart stopped and there was no blood pressure, everybody knew that unless that circulation could be started moving again within 2 to 3 minutes, the patient's brain would be irreparably damaged and he would perhaps come out alive, but if too much time had elapsed, he would never be a thinking human being again. Well, when do you continue these life-saving things after irreparable damage has been done? Has a doctor a right to keep somebody alive who is otherwise dead? And Dr. Reneerson was quite a crusader many years ago for the fact that when a person with severe cerebral damage who is irreparably had become a vegetative individual, one shouldn't feel either obligated or you don't have the right to keep a person like that alive mechanically, just for the sake of signing the death certificate on a date, a month, or a year in the future.
There is something worse than death, and that can be life. But, you know, it depends on how you define life. I mean, like the fellow asked the chicken farmer, you know, what do you do? He says, well, I raise chickens. Why do you raise chickens? Well, so people can have chickens to eat, to feed them. He says, why feed them? So, well, I guess so they can live.
I've sometimes thought if you could take away all the hospital trappings, the white claws, the dignity of a fine educated mind, the long search of the human race for these various comfort mechanisms surrounding it, and reduce this simply to keeping this particular physical organism alive, you would say this was cruel. You know, if you took away all the rest, you'd say somebody's being cruel here. I mean, this is how you'd feel. And I think that you have to somehow find a way together here for our times to establish when is compassion no longer present, but simply a kind of pride, we can keep this body alive. We know how to do it, you know. And we know a lot of things that we don't do, fortunately, for all of us.
Yeah, I'm going to address that, but you got to let me finish my chicken story. So he says, you know, why do they want to live, you know? And that's where everybody meets an obstacle, you know. Well, You know, you've got to answer this question, and a lot of people don't, you know. And of course, the farmer said, well, I guess he can live and raise chickens, you know, but that's just about as far as some of us go, you know. Now, I want to address this thing of yours. And I told you yesterday about some of the studies of at the University of Washington by Dudley and his associates on where they took these 40 critical people with respiratory problems, and 29 of the 40 died during the 4 years on this particular study. And he said that few people realize what a dying person really experiences. And this was an investigation into trying to figure out what do they really experience in the dying process. And as they became critical, they had very concentrated attention by the psychiatrist to answer certain questions. And the patients were cooperating in this. They were informed about this situation. Because Dudley and others realized that there is hardly anything really known about this. And one of the patients said, I think it is high time that we throw some light on the subject and study it together. I can face anything I understand much easier than something I do not. Well, maybe you can argue about that. But in the course of this, I mentioned yesterday that the discomfort of the patient did not appear to be related to the dying behavior, but this was the interpretation of those observing the patient, and that really the dying behavior in this particular series, now we can give exceptions to this, we can take Carol's father as an exception, that the dying behavior was not in itself uncomfortable. Subjects regarded death as a natural evolution of life, and dying behavior itself was regarded as comfortable, even a pleasant experience, as they followed these till they died. On these particular patients, this is a respiratory involvement in most cases. And then they, in assessing the medical profession, one of the patients said, they are resentful, they do not want to face facts, they prefer to hang on to hope. I do not really blame the poor dears. They have worked so hard, above and beyond what they needed to do. And then a very interesting situation was a lady. And she was coming comatose and unconscious. And this unconsciousness was a very peaceful, of course, and relaxing thing. But the waking was very painful. And she feared resuscitation. She didn't want it. I mean, it was a very painful thing to her. And she regarded death as an adventure. And the fear and the pain she had was that, I mean, don't resuscitate me. And then she asked if death upset the doctor. And he, of course, I mean, he was very much involved because, boy, I mean, you know, they want to hang in there. And he said yes. And she consoled him and said that she was glad that she didn't have his job. And she's dying. Now, and you're going to face this situation, and this is why you see the conflict, you know. The medical staff there, when they more or less said, well, you know, I mean, she wants to die, she's comatose. I mean, why keep resuscitating, you know? The medical staff resisted it, and the nurses said, well, you're letting her die, you know. And so you have this conflict. And then also, in my point, that I have a hard time with in looking at my own situation. When I get to this state, I don't want these heroic things, some of them which are exceedingly expensive, because I would rather, and you can shoot 20,000 or 30,000. You can say, well, that's only money, you know. But what will 20,000 and 30,000 do as far as saving the life of a child with a whole life in front of them? I mean, this is why I think that we do not have unlimited resources.
Yeah, but you see? Listen, if you might be the 1 out of 10 who might possibly make a recovery and probably be a good professor for another 5 years, it would be too bad to let you die, wouldn't it?
Not if my mental facilities were
There's
compromised.
There's a question of judgment comes in there, yeah. The physician and the surgeon. If it's totally irreversible and obvious that recovery is not in the books. That's the one we're talking about. We're not talking about somebody that might possibly, even quite very improbably, make a recovery. That's not the kind of a case we're talking about.
Yeah, but you see, we do have this situation. I mean, we just cited one, and there are many in the annals, you know. But you keep them alive for years, and they're not functioning.
Leo, I have to still argue for life over against the academy here for a moment.
Okay.
And that is, you say, not if my mental functions were impaired. What if your whimsy, what if this crazy reverse Norsky humor of yours were still there? Not the sharpness of your memory, not your knowledge of many intimate acquaintances in the front ranks of research at this hour.
Well, my memory's all gone anyway.
But what if you, we know different, but what if your person was still there to refresh the rest of us? And you op out and you say, no, sir. See?
Well, you see, I too was in prison camp and I was in combat. And I'll admit, you know, that there's a lot. That's the easy way out. I'll admit this.
Well, you know, you heard a lot of guys say it. I heard one guy all night say, let me die, let me die, let me die. And he was dead in the morning. But by that time, we had gotten the plasma and he was being given it. This is one of the fellows of this. Guys 2 weeks from the survivors of Bataan to send to Japan. And he was a mess, sure. But everybody there was pulling him. He had three nurses, he had a doctor. We were in the midst of combat. The fighters on both sides right then. They were giving this guy everything to make him one of those they could still pull through. We'd been losing two a night. We went on losing one or two a day for the next week or so. But this guy had a chance. And he just says, let me die, let me die. And he was dead in the morning. Boy, I tell you, listen to that all night long. It gets to you.
Well, it's a very, listen, and this brings up a very important issue. You know, is this an active process? Yes, it is an active process. And this wishing death, that Wolf wrote a book, I think, called The Turned Off Heart. And we know now that one has control of some of what we didn't think we had control of before. And I think the statistics indicate, and you might check this, I mean, In certain orthopedic hospitals or children's hospitals, where the child says, I'm going to die, you know, he's a very poor risk. Or he says, well, I'm going to live. He's a good risk. Or this person that says, I'm going to die, you know, that has figures into it very much.
Oh,
you haven't looked at that. From a medical, ethical point of view, and medicine has its code of ethics, as you well know, it certainly would be entirely unprofessional, unethical, and morally wrong for any doctor to permit somebody to die because they wanted to die. That doesn't come into the picture at all. The wish to die isn't the criterion at all for allowing anybody to die.
No, that's right. No.
It's just tougher to keep them alive.
No, I don't want to infer that. What I'm saying is, it's just tougher to make to recover because they're not with you.
Oh, that's
and
right.
They can really reduce your chances of success.
Oh, very much.
And this is the point I'm making. I mean, if you decide that you're going to die, you're a poor risk.
Right.
If you don't have this psychosocial attitude that's proper, boy, you're a very, very poor risk. And this is a
part of the risk.
This is an important issue.
That's why the imagery, I think, surrounds you is so important. Now, Fritz talked here when he's here about sorcery being the biggest hindrance to medicine in New Guinea. And he said, these are Royal College of Surgeons and medicine. They're top men. They say the sorcerers are the ones that I am. Who will deliver me from this body of death? That's the first bracket for tonight's Vespers. And the other bracket for it is, thanks be to God through Jesus Christ our Lord. Wretched man that I am, who will deliver me from this body of death? This plaintive note of the solo you've just heard sung, that he came for poor sinners like you and me. In the mission of history, no story has more pathos for me nor more pointedness than that which comes from the early evangelizing of England, when the missionaries had reached Northumbria, and the king here had called his counselors together to listen to the missionary around a fire much like ours, except there was an open hole in the ceiling for the smoke to go through. There were chinks in the walls and not windows. And as the missionary spoke of the good news and the story of Jesus, a sparrow had flown in by the fire. It was in December. It was the same kind of weather that we've been enjoying and perhaps not always enjoying here right now. And the kind of cold had gotten into the bones of them all. And they were listening to this particular story, and the sparrow joined them and warmed himself and then flew out again into the Advent winter and cold. And when the man was through with his message, the king turned to his chief druid, these men who have taught us still to knock on wood because the gods are against us and envy our happiness. And the king asked him, "What do you make of this?" And this was one of those honest, fair-minded guys that fortunately the world has. You don't have to be a Christian to be a fair-minded fellow, or there would be no such thing as justice. And he said, "Well, King, you saw the sparrow that came in as he was talking." And he says, "That's like our life." He says, "For a few moments, warmed by the fire and back again. For we came, we know not whence we go. Whither we go, we know not, but there's a few moments by the fire." Unless this story is true. I read for you from one of the most graphic descriptions of death in the history of men. Some people think I love the sauna up here because I am using the sauna to replace this kind of a spiritual exercise of Ignatius Loyola. Some of you know about it, I presume, from your reading in history. Many may have read the Meditations. Here's where he appeals to your imagination on death. I read it as a contrast to the biblical kind of emphasis which keeps your imagination on life and the resurrection. Here's St. Ignatius' third exercise on death. Application of the sight. Consider, one, a few moments after your death, your body laid on a funeral bed, wrapped in a shroud, a veil thrown over your face. I wish you'd take 5 minutes to meditate on that one. Beside you, the crucifix, the holy water, relatives, friends, a priest kneeling by your sad remains and reciting the holy prayers. Out of the depths have I called unto thee, O Lord. He uses the Latin, of course, De profundis clamaviat te Domini. The public officer who writes in the register of the dead all the particulars of your disease, and now the notice in the paper and the closing of your shop, in memory, of course. Such a death, such a year, such an hour. The servants all occupied with the preparation for your funeral. Two, the day after your death. Your inanimate body enclosed in a coffin covered with a pall, taken from your apartment, sadly carried to the foot of the altar, received by the priest of Jesus Christ, deposited for the Lord, present in the tabernacle. Then the holy sacrifice over, laid in its last home, the grave. Consider well the dismal field where the eye sees nothing but tombs. You've seen the Genoa. The General Cemetery, know how some of these European cemeteries looked. It's like a mountain of tombs. This open grave where they're laying your body, the priest who blesses you for the last time, your relatives and friends who contemplate the spectacle with fear, the grave digger who ends the scene by throwing earth on your coffin. Three, some months after your death. Contemplate this stone already blackened by time, this inscription beginning to be effaced. And under that stone, in that coffin which is crumbling bit by bit, contemplate the sad state of your body. See how the worms devour the remains of putrid flesh. All the limbs are separating. How the bones are eaten away by the corruption of the tomb. See what remains of the body you've loved so much, as something which has no name in any tongue, and on which we cannot think without disgust. Application of the hearing. Go through again the different scenes which you are the spectacle. Listen to the dismal sound of the bells which announce your death and which beg the prayers of the faithful for your soul. Two, the prayers which they recite at the foot of your bed. Saints of God come to its assistance. Angels of God come to its help. Receive his soul. Eternal rest give unto him, O Lord, and let perpetual light shine upon him. Three, the remarks of the servants who speak of you. Four, your friends and relatives who communicate to each other the reflections on your death and mutually console each other for your loss. Five, the assistants called in to arrange your funeral who speak of you with cold indifference. Six, the chants of the church during the funeral service. Deliver me, Lord, from eternal death in that dreadful day when the heavens and the earth shall tremble and thou shalt come to judge the world by fire. That day, a day of wrath, of calamity, and of misery, that great and very bitter day. 7. The conversations of the persons whom duty, friendship, or civility call to your funeral. 8. What is said of you in society after your death. Examine well all these circumstances and conclude by making a resolution to detach yourself from creatures and belong to God alone. Now you're kind of getting the old punchline, see? Application of the smell and touch. Imagine yourself respiring the odor your body exhales when the soul is departed. The infection would give out if were taken from the coffin a few months after your death. Imagine you touch this damp earth where they have laid you, this shroud in which they have wrapped you, and which is now in rags, this bare skull, once the seat of thought, these dismembered limbs which once obeyed all the orders of your will. In fine, this mass of corruption which the sepulchre has enclosed a few months, and the sight of which is horrible. In presence of this terrible scene, ask yourself what are health, fortune, friendship of the world, pleasures of the senses, life itself. Vanity, vanity, all is vanity. Well, you've spent the first week in that contemplation, and you can imagine something of what happens for you, perhaps. At least it's quite a different tone from our day, where we simply dismiss it, where it is now not unusual, in fact, almost customary, in that section of our country which I have sometimes proposed that we join with the rest of Southern California we didn't get from Mexico and make a separate nation of it and call it Lizardia, where people live for lying in the sun. And down in that section of our country where there are a number of older people, it's not unusual for relatives to call and ask the undertaker to take the body, and they never appear. They're through with it. They don't want to be confronted by death. And that's the opposite kind of the picture. We just don't think about it. We dismiss it. The scriptures are not either so dolorous nor severe in their embrace of our imagination, but they do capture us with this knowledge of the fact that death confronts us all. But greater than death is the life that confronts us. Who will deliver me from this body of death? There is therefore now no condemnation for those who are in Christ Jesus. For the law of spirit of life in Christ Jesus has set me free from the law of sin and death. For God has done what the law weakened by the flesh could not do. Sending his own Son in the likeness of sinful flesh and for sin, he condemned sin in the flesh in order that the just requirements of the law might be fulfilled in us who walk not according to the flesh but according to the Spirit. For those who live according to the flesh set their minds on the things of the flesh, but those who live according to the Spirit set their minds on the things of the Spirit. To set the mind on the flesh is death, but to set the mind on the Spirit is life and peace.